Judiciary Committee. We are going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 14. And I'll open that public hearing and ask Lane Sawyer and Mickey Cerise to come forward. And welcome, and whoever would like to begin.
Chairman Williams and members of the committee, I'm Lane Sawyer, manager of the Oregon State Archives Division, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 14A. Senate Bill 14A removes specific language regarding the retention of child abuse records from statute and allows the state archivist to establish a records retention schedule that specifies the length of time these records must be retained before they may be destroyed. Senate Bill 14A also removed wording that did not accurately reflect the custodian of these records. Records in the custody of the state archivists are permanent assets of the state and its citizens. Records with less than permanent retention, such as child abuse records, remain in the custody of the agency, although they may be housed in the state records center. In that case, the state archivist serves as an agent of the creating agency. DHS child welfare staff met with the state archives staff and Senator Ferrioli to help draft amendments to Senate Bill 14, and members of the work group were in consensus regarding the amendments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Cerise.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm special assistant, and I work in the area of children, adults, and families with the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 14A, and to give you a little bit of information of why we're doing this. Currently, in ORS 192-105, the statutes read that child welfare records are maintained for 75 years if there's a substantiated or founded child abuse record. If the disposition is unfounded or unsubstantiated, we're to maintain those records for 30 years. The amendments to Senate Bill 14, which are in the Dash A version, allows the state archivist to use the administrative rule process to set the timelines. During the meeting that Ms. Sawyer referenced, we discussed a more reasonable timeline of 12 years for founded or substantiated cases and 6 years for unfounded, unsubstantiated cases. We believe that these later timelines are more consistent with what is taking place nationally with other states. We also believe that these newer timelines will help us comply with the upcoming HIPAA federal requirements. So we are in support of Senate Bill 14A. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for either Ms. Sawyer or Mr. Cerise? What was the reason, Mickey, or perhaps the Ms. Sawyer, you'll know, that originally that those records had a 75-year retention date on them? Anybody look into the history of what would have caused our predecessing colleagues to have decided that 75 years was an appropriate time frame to maintain those records?
Just prior to this hearing, we were talking with Mickey about that, and the other staff person from the State Archives that was here, her recollection was that a person who had a suppressed memory of child abuse had been unable to substantiate that because records were not available to her. And so the change in the retention for those were added into statute, I believe, in 95.
Wow, 95. So that was a recent...
What? Oh, in 89. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that would have been probably more consistent with when the whole repressed memory syndrome issue was sort of starting to percolate. All right, are there further questions? Okay, thank you both. Kelly Skye, appearing today in a neutral position.
Imagine that.
And a neutral color.
Good afternoon. Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm testifying in a neutral position because after talking to the proponents of the bill, they've let me know that there may be room for us to take part in some of the rulemaking process. The concern from our membership comes from capital defenders and federal defenders who are defending people where the decision of whether they will have life or death may rest on the existence of some of the records that we're talking about. And that is because when a person finds themselves in the position of being charged with a capital crime or for many federal crimes where the sentences are essentially life, those attorneys, the great portion of their practice is finding the mitigating evidence. And if a client tells them that that they believe that they were exposed to controlled substances or alcohol while they were in utero or they were subjected to abuse or neglect as a child, obtaining those records can make a huge difference in negotiating and presenting one of those cases. And so those members are concerned about the ever-shortening retention periods of all types of records, and this bill happened to pop onto the radar screen as I was talking to them about those issues. So I'm merely here to raise this issue for you as something to keep in mind. There are reasons to keep these records. I don't know if 75 years is necessary, but there are people to whom these records are very important, and they're members of my organization, so I wanted to let you know their concerns.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Skye, Representative Barker?
What do you think would be an appropriate time? Because that raises something I hadn't thought of.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, I did not come prepared with a time schedule. I'm thinking that if someone's records date back to when they were a child and they commit a crime at the age of 50, they're still going to be wanting those records. Now, part of what I did learn prior to this hearing and speaking with the state archivist is that some of the records that we would be looking for would be in the foster care records, which are retained for a much longer time than the actual initial reports. Because as reports of abuse or neglect come in through the hotline, they're declared either founded or unfounded. The unfounded reports would then be released much earlier, but the founded reports, assuming that child was removed from their parent and placed into foster care, it would then create a foster care record, which would be retained for a much longer period. So those records will be available. It's the unfounded records and the actual founded records. If the child is never taken into care, so they could have suffered those, the abuse or neglect, but the court for some reason did not remove the child from the parents, then those records would be destroyed if the retention periods weren't kept. So, but I couldn't give you a timeline.
You may follow up.
If a child is beat up by the mother's boyfriend or abused by the mother's boyfriend and the mother's boyfriend leaves and the court leaves the child with the mother, that would not then fall into your circumstance of the child being removed?
Correct. That may very well be. And frequently, because in juvenile court, only one parent or the other has to be determined to be minimally adequate. So if the second parent steps forward, the court may not take that child into care. And that's a perfect example of where those substantiated or founded complaints may be necessary in these later cases.
Are you satisfied that you can work out, that you can be satisfied with the result of the rules here?
Well, Chair Williams, Representative Barker, in speaking with Mr. Sharice and the state archivist, they have offered to have some meetings during the interim to talk about these issues, and what I would want to do is get some of our members that do the capital defense work together with them to discuss those issues, because the Department of Human Services has input into the state archivist rulemaking process, and apparently in the state archivist rulemaking process as to other agencies aside from DHS, there is an opportunity for public comment. So I'm going to try to get those people together.
Okay. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the committee's benefit and Ms. Skye's benefit, I think I might be the only institutional knowledge here on the meetings that took place in the Senate on this bill with Senator Farioli. I was hoping that he might be able to be here today to testify on behalf of the bill. But it was my understanding that, yes, it's correct, the 75-year number did come during the height of the repressed memory phenomenon, and that that theory to some extent has been kind of debunked now. And it's quite a burden to keep these records for this period of time and maintain their confidentiality. And it was agreed that the rulemaking process was the proper process to go through deciding how long these records were going to be kept. And with the caveat that we understand we cannot mandate any particular rulemaking process, it was agreed upon that the general gist would be 6 years for unsubstantiated records, because that is the minimum amount of time that they need to be kept for HIPAA purposes, because these records may or may not include health information. And rather than having DHS search through them to determine if they do or don't and then separating those out, it was felt that we just keep all of them for 6 years, and therefore if they do contain any kind of health information, we'd be complying with HIPAA. And then for substantiated records, those would be kept for 12 years, and we took a survey of all the other states in the union as to how long records were kept by various states, and while the states were kind of all over the board, there was a general average of about 10 years, and so we would be 2 years beyond the general average for most states. Are actually 10 years or less, but there were some that were quite a bit longer, and we felt that 12 years was double six. It was an easy number to remember, and it was a good amount of, a good long amount of time that these children would go into their teens and 20s, and probably these records would thereafter be probably irrelevant. And so that was the general consensus, six, and we would also be eliminating, there was a whole myriad of categories for these types of records. The only one that I remember other than substantiated and unsubstantiated at this time was something that was like dismissed out of hand, or I don't know, they're not put in the file, something like that. And we thought it was also a burden to categorize these records in these various different categories, and rather we should simply have either they were substantiated or they weren't substantiated in the two different time periods for those. So I don't know if that helps you at all, but that was my understanding in the Senate when we came upon this this amendment as the compromise.
Okay, that's helpful. That gives us an idea how that came. Any questions for Ms. Skye before we let her go? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Anybody else here on Senate Bill 14? Okay, we'll close. Yes.
In that discussion, if you have a minor, are the records going to be retained for those period of time, 16, 12 years, from majority or from the time that the occurrence or the belief of something substantiated or unsubstantiated?
That was something else we talked about, and again, with we were interested in reducing the burden to the extent possible on the record keepers to look in the records for substantive information and then categorize them based on that information. So it was my understanding that the date would be from the date the record came into existence, not the birth date, not the type of abuse, other than whether it was substantiated or unsubstantiated. So it would be the time the record came into the possession of DHS. I assume actually it would be from the time the record was made, the report was made, whether it was in DHS's hands or otherwise.
Okay. Are we going to go to work session?
That was my intent.
I have a question. I don't know if you want to discuss it now or you'll wait till work session.
Why don't we do it in work session? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 14, open a work session. Representative Brzozowski.
I'm just wondering if the record's created, let's say it's a child that's 3 to 6 years of age, it's unsubstantiated, that means the record is going to be destroyed before that child reaches majority. And if even if it was substantiated and if the child was six or less, it would be destroyed before majority. Are we looking at some issues here that that child, when they become of age, if they wanted to take some type of action? I'm not sure if this is something that was discussed or if we need to even be concerned with. It's not an area of tort. I don't do that type of law, but just something knowing that in previous years there was always an attempt to make certain that we didn't obstruct a child when they became a majority, he or she, to move forward on their own. I just throw that out. I'm just not an area that I practice in.
If I might.
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Przanski, it seems like if DHS could categorize the bills based on intake, they could just as easily categorize them based on date of birth of the victim, and then not categorize them based on date of intake and just take the 6 and 12 years from that date. But obviously then it would have to be 6 or 12 years after they reach majority, I assume, would be the operable. And so you'd have to figure out when they would reach majority and then you do 6 or 12 years from that. Obviously, that would, in some cases, extend the time period that we're going to keep these records quite a bit from just a straight 6 or 12 years.
Yeah. And also, I think this discussion we're having is more for the records, so when they can go into the rulemaking. I'm not sure what the length of time for filing a claim, but it would seem like if the examples I've given, if majority's at 18, and if, let's say, the statute of limitation would run in 3, it would need to be held only until that 3 years, and they would have complied with everything else. So that's just food for thought.
Representative Ackerman, and then Mickey, why don't you come back up to the desk. Ms. Sawyer, do you want to come back up too? Do you have an opinion on this? Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, it's just to pick up on Representative Przanski's point. I know there's a very long statute of limitations for abuse cases involving minors. I don't know. I can't remember the formula right now, but it's very, very long. I would think that any records retention should at least be for the statute of limitations with respect to the victim at the minimum requirement.
Mickey?
Thank you, Chair Williams. And for the record, again, my name is Mickey Cerise. Just a point of clarification, the 6-year and 12-year timeline is from the date of closure for the record. So theoretically, if we had a situation where we had a child abuse record that went for 4 years and then we had a subsequent call on that particular family, the first referral would fold into the second referral because we keep one record on the family. So theoretically, the record itself could stay open longer than 12 years because of the term from the date of closure. Wouldn't be the date that we originally took the call.
But may.
You may.
Mickey, the only thing I would suggest Representative Ackerman is brought this point out. You may want to check with the attorneys as to making certain that the department is fulfilling its obligation to retain the records at least until the statute of limitations run for that child of once becoming a majority to be able to act on their own capacity if they wanted to take some type of legal action.
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, I think that's great advice, and it sounds like we'll be meeting during the interim to discuss that, and we'll make sure we have legal counsel with us.
Anybody else? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
You represent Przanski.
Get ready for a motion.
Yeah.
I'd move SB 14A to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 14A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Go ahead and call the roll. Ann?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 14A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer on a carrier?
I'll do it if you like.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 17A. Mr. Junda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junda. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. Senate Bill 17 has to do with the area of discrimination, particularly for people with disabilities. Right now, in Oregon, there is a law federal law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities by federal and state government and other local government entities. What prompted this particular bill is two things. One is that in Oregon law, while there are prohibitions against this type of discrimination in a whole variety of areas, there is not any protection in the area of state or local government services. This really hasn't been a concern because the Americans with Disabilities Act covers the area. However, starting about 5 years ago now, more like 6 years ago, a series of cases started to roll out of the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with the concept of sovereign immunity and whether the Congress can enact laws that essentially tell states what to do and then open states up to enforcement of those laws. The concern here was that the Americans with Disabilities Act would be affected, and in fact, the Supreme Court has held that at least in the area of employment, that the federal government cannot legislate in that area. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's Title I of the ADA. There's another portion of the ADA, section Title II, which governs public services. And the Supreme Court actually had a case pending before this session that would have decided whether this concept of sovereign immunity applied in this area. And it was a case that had come out of California. California, however, withdrew its appeal in that case, and the Supreme Court never ruled on it. However, there's still concern from disability advocates, of course, that should a case of this sort come before the Supreme Court, that we might be left in Oregon without any protection in terms of state services. This is not a problem with local government. It's only a problem with state government and specifically state services. The Senate Bill 17 before you is designed really to mimic the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act only as it pertains to state government services. And it's narrowly drawn to do so. And as my testimony indicates, there are certain provisions that are included to specify that this bill would not create any new entitlement to services, any requirement that services be provided if they would be financially unreasonable or burdensome or change the nature of state services. These concepts are strictly in line with the federal protections and which we have been living with now for 12 years.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Bob, we had a bill similar to this in the last session. And my recollection after you and I talked earlier today as I was thinking about it, it got high-centered along the road somewhere. And there were people who were opposed to it. Nobody seems to be opposed to this bill. No one signed up in opposition. So I'm assuming that whatever we've done differently in Senate Bill 17 has answered those concerns. Am I right about that?
We've had 4 years to work on trying to winnow out the problems in the bill. And specifically, narrowing this breadth of the bill in only to state government, I think, is taking care of it.
Okay. All right. Are there questions? Explain to me, Bob, in a situation where a person would have a person now who previously thought that they could have sued if for some reason there was an ADA-like violation by a state government or a government entity, nature of a service or an accommodation, would they sue just like they would under the ADA, but they would sue essentially under this language? Is that how that would work?
Mr. Chair, perhaps they would. They would have the option of doing that. Of course,
right.
It would be in state court as opposed to federal court. But also they'd have the option of using the BOLI process.
Mm-hmm.
So they could file essentially an administrative complaint, and BOLI could take it through their process, which usually involves investigation, determination of whether there's a violation, and then an attempt at some sort of reconciliation of the problem.
And your point in your testimony with respect to the remedy, that the remedies would be the same for a claim of discrimination and public accommodation. So either way, they get essentially the same remedy they would have gotten under the ADA, as if the ADA was held to apply to states.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And you might recall last session, Boley did testify at that time about the bill, and it informed this committee that that Boley looks to the ADA and disability discrimination in terms of how they evaluate cases. And I would expect that that would continue to be the case.
Okay. All right. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in some of the new language it talks about the drugs, illegal use of drugs, and so on, and then it says the exemption is authorized under controlled substance acts or under other provisions of state or federal law. So does this help protect the people who are medical marijuana patients?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I don't know the answer to that question. This language is added by legislative counsel to clarify the existing law.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Representative Sherry.
Well, actually, that language, I think this is one of these cases where legislative counsel was just alphabetizing. If you look on page 2, they just carry back the same definition, so I don't think that makes a change. Whatever it does, it doesn't do anything related to what this bill does.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly agree with the overall intent of the bill, because it basically protects the disabled person from governmental agents from discriminating against them. I do hear quite frequently complaints that possibly ADA has gone too far in this area or that. I'm sure you hear that even more. What ability is there to negotiate changes that roll back some of the decisions? Is there a fairly good flexibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, probably what you hear about most in ADA is employment issues. And as someone who follows this area of law, I know that successful cases in this area are actually the exception rather than the rule. That having been said, one of the good aspects of the ADA, in my opinion, is that it requires, in order for when a person believes that they're suffering some sort of limitation. And let's just take an example. They want to participate in a court proceeding and they're deaf and they need an interpreter. They have an obligation to bring that to the attention of the court, in this case, and then participate in an interactive process in order to determine what's the best accommodation for that person. And so this isn't the type of... the structure of these laws does not allow a person to bushwhack, if you will, a government entity and say, you should have known that I had this problem and figured out something to do for me. And these concepts have been worked out both in those statutes and in federal regulations, which I said Boley has been pretty good in following. So I think, at least in terms of Title II, it's an area that... where there's a good, settled process for resolving problems and making sure that people aren't blindsided.
Okay. You mentioned, follow-up?
Yes.
That was through the courts. Are there any other avenues where the public can ask for a reduction of some of the laws that are already there, protection laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there are... In terms of reduction of law,
let me give you an example.
I'm not sure.
I think you've probably all been to a store like Walmart or Costco and seen 40 different disabled parking places and none of them being used, or one or two being used. And it just seems to me at some point we need to be able to go into ADA and say, in issues like that, that's not reasonable. Let's make it proportional to the number that are being used over a long period of time. That's just one very simple illustration. But is there a negotiation process that can be used in that kind of situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, many of the standards that your this particular example that you used is really one that was developed out of federal regulation.
Yeah, right.
And so I would the wording of the ADA itself is fairly broad. And so if I was someone who had a particular interest in that area, I think what I would do is I would attempt to get a change in interpretation of that particular provision by the appropriate federal agency.
But aren't we tying ourselves in by this bill to the federal regulation?
In terms of Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think for the most part that you are, that the although it does obviously allow BOLI to develop its own interpretations of the statute, and so that if BOLI chose to develop an administrative rule that deviated from the ADA, there's nothing in this law that would prevent them from doing so.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, just a footnote and maybe a partial answer to Representative Anderson's question. The courts, in my experience, have been going through limitation process on what constitutes a disabled person, just by case law. Secondly, at the state level and the federal level, you have regulations which still can fine-tune those definitions. And again, depending upon your disability situation, whether you choose a federal remedy or state remedy, each has separate advantages and disadvantages. Some have limitations, for example, on the number of employees if it's an employment situation. And so it's kind of hard to ferret all the way through it, but there are a number of controlling devices that are already on the books and that are being evolved.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Bob. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 17? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 17A.
Are you ready for a motion?
I do.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 17A be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker moves that Senate Bill 17A move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Krasonski?
Aye.
Representative Federley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Aye. Senate Bill 17A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Got a volunteer for Carrier? Representative Barker. Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 38. And I will ask Kathy Ledesma, Robin Pope, and even though he's on their opposite side of them, David Niebel. Since there are just three of you, it would be nice for you to all sit next to each other, and we'll just do this all at once. And I don't know if you can tell by the energy of the committee today, but this is our first day without coffee being provided in the hearing room.
Water.
I'll be right back.
Hey, get on. Kathy, you were on the list first, but it looks like you were looking to Robin. So you're the pitch person, huh? Okay.
I am the pitch person. Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. My name is Robin Pope, and I've appeared in front of you previously, and some of my credentials are listed in my written testimony, so I won't repeat them. I would ask that my statement be submitted for the record today. We're here today with Senate Bill 38A, which has now passed the Senate. And as just a little bit of background, in 1999, the Oregon Legislature adopted the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act, We used to have the UCCJA, which was missing the E part, the enforcement part. And when this was passed in 1999, adoptions were specifically included as covered by the UCCJEA. And what has happened since 1999 is that there have been numerous instances, including a case that went up on appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Bone v. McCulley case, where when there were competing jurisdictions, i.e. two states involved, it created difficulty in terms of deciding which state had jurisdiction for the filing of the adoption. And that has created difficulties for Oregonians, both adoptive parents and birth parents. We drafted Senate Bill 38 in the hopes of fixing this problem. When we initially appeared in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, there were some objections from DHS, from the state of Oregon, and also from Oregon Legal Services, Ellen Mendoza. A work committee was formed, consisting of Senators Vicky Walker and Ted Ferrioli, and then Attorney John Challey, who's also an adoption attorney, myself, Kathy Ledesma, Mickey Logan of the Department of Justice, and Ellen Mendoza attended that work session. It was actually quite lengthy. We had a great deal of discussion about the philosophy behind Senate Bill 58, why we felt it was important to make this fix. And ultimately, we reached agreement on the form of some amendments to Senate Bill 38 and pulled adoptions back under the umbrella of the UCCJEA, except we removed what we call home state primacy. And Ellen Mendoza isn't here today, but that's why David Niebel's here on her behalf. And she continues to have a philosophical objection to this. But what Senators Walker and Ferrioli advised us in the work session was that we were to work out the language, and if we could reach agreement on that, ultimately the philosophical decision would be yours, collectively, the Senate and the House. The rest of us agree both philosophically and on the amended language, so we've all made compromises and reached agreement. And what is before you today is a result of those compromises. We believe very strongly that this change is important. And one of the reasons why is, I'm going to give you an example. I've had clients who've adopted babies who were born in Idaho. And in the state of Idaho, a non-resident cannot file an adoption proceeding. So my clients, who were Oregon residents, were adopting this child, and the birth mother wanted them to adopt this child, but they couldn't file and finalize their adoption in the state of Idaho. So we come over to Oregon and we file it here. Under the current status of the law, there's some ambiguity there, and I have to disclose that to my clients. We file here anyway because we have nowhere else to file. We do that, and there's a concern, but we finalize the adoption. It is now done. That happens with other states also who say non-residents cannot file. Under Senate Bill 38A, we are fixing that problem, and we are saying that if the petitioners, the adoptive parents, have resided here for at least 6 months and there is substantial evidence concerning the care for this child available in this state, Oregon would have jurisdiction to finalize this adoption. In the situation with the Idaho baby, if we didn't make that change, we leave those people at risk and we open up that adoption to risk and to challenge. Now, I know that that's one of the philosophical problems that Ms. Mendoza has with this, but ultimately, when we had our work session, we discussed all of these issues, and the senators advised us that that philosophical decision was up to all of you. We're encouraging you to understand that it's important that it's important for Oregonians, both for birth parent Oregonians and for adopted parent Oregonians and for these children, that Oregon have a sound jurisdictional framework for adoption so that when adoptions are completed here, people know that they are completed in a legal fashion and they're solid. And I can't stress enough, I deal with adoptions on a daily basis for my clients, and I represent both sides, sometimes a birth parent, sometimes adoptive parents. And I understand how important these decisions are to people, and that there be finality and that it be done in a careful manner. Adoption is fairly unique. It's not like your typical custody case. And so I would like you to realize that the UCCJEA was specifically drawn up. It's a uniform law that's been adopted, I believe, now by at least 31 states. It's fascinating because I did a poll on all 50 states, and I didn't get responses from everyone, but I got responses from lawyers in a number of those states. And in 31 states who've adopted the UCCJEA, the vast majority of them specifically excluded adoptions completely. So they don't even cover adoptions, and they either have a separate jurisdictional basis in their law or they have nothing. And we don't want that to happen in Oregon. We don't want nothing there, but we want a very careful, clear framework. And in our work group, one of the reasons we decided to leave adoptions under the UCCJEA, yet remove that home state primacy, is that there's a common belief that there are protective provisions in the UCCJEA that help protect everyone in this situation, the adoptive parents, the birth parents, the child. And it also provides a framework for judges when we have a dispute between two states. So let's say the baby's born in New Jersey, the adoption gets filed here, the birth parent in New Jersey wants to object to the adoption. The question becomes, where do they object? Do they object in New Jersey? Do they object in Oregon? What we've done with Senate Bill 38A is we have provided for that, and we have allowed a way for the courts to communicate with one another and to work that objection out, come up with a resolution. We believe strongly that we have right now an ambiguity in the law. We have a problem where Oregonians are not protected adequately in certain adoptions, and that this is the way to fix it. That we've actually worked very hard on this, the work group, and come up with what we believe is a good compromise, and we would encourage you to accept our compromise and pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Ledesma, do you have anything to add?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the adoptions manager at the Department of Human Services, and I am here today to speak on behalf of the Department of Human Services in support of this of Senate Bill 38A. When I was here last week and we sat through a series of hearings before we came up to the table on another bill, the second fellow who always went said what he said. And that's what I'm here to say. We do support for the very reasons that Robin has laid out here. So what she said, we go. We, in January when this bill was introduced, we had a long laundry list of concerns about it. And that work group really did work everything out. The bulk of our concerns were really around creating those tri-state adoptions in which nobody really had a secure tie to the state of Oregon, in which it was a pass-through adoption, and we were really concerned about the national reputation that we had had for many years as being the land of easy adoption, where you could just come here and anybody could do an adoption here. In calendar year 2002, 1,963 children who were a part of adoption proceedings and were not in the custody of the state of Oregon, so these are all those other adoptions out there, went through the Interstate Compact on the placement of children in the ICPC in the state of Oregon. So really potentially could have affected almost 2,000 children a year. Those issues were resolved by putting in the residency requirements, by removing any possibility that residency requirement could apply solely to an adoption agency. So it isn't enough just to have the adoption agency be in the state of Oregon. That was not a significant enough tie. It also, as a result of the work in the work group, we put in a definition for periods of temporary absence, which limits it to 30 days in the six-month period preceding the adoption. Really took care of all of our concerns, and we have no fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Well, David, is the naysayer at the table.
Mr. Chair, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. And I am here to oppose Senate Bill 38. What Ms. Pope and Ms. Ledesma have said about the work group, I understand, is absolutely accurate. They did work very hard to come up with good amendments to Senate Bill 38. that I think substantially dealt with a number of problems that my colleague Ella Mendoza, who's been referred to, had raised with the initial bill. There is one issue, though, that I think that we're just going to have to agree to disagree here on, and that's the issue about that leaves our clients, that is low-income clients, open to inappropriate terminations of parental rights. The scenario, I created a scenario in my written testimony that I think is instructive, and the scenario is that let's say you have a birth parent who lives in Chicago who's looking into surgery and has a child who she sends to Oregon for a month to stay with the grandmother, that is the birth parent's mother. There's nothing that would prevent this grandmother from filing an adoption proceeding upon the arrival of the child in Oregon, because jurisdiction would attach to the adoptive parent, since the adoptive parent has been here for 6 months, and there's substantial evidence about the care that the child would receive in Oregon. That creates big problems for clients in the situation I've described who, I mean, that's an extreme case, but she's 2,000 miles away, she's low income, and she's disabled temporarily. And it's very difficult to mount a defense to an adoption proceeding of that kind in those situations. I think it's Ms. Mendoza's position that this law is not really broken in this way, and that it's unfair. It would be unfair to create a situation where that set of facts could arise. And so that's the reason why we're in opposition to this bill.
Okay. I want to give Ms. Pope an opportunity to respond to your example.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I'd like to make the response very simple. And the example given by Mr. Nabel, consent to an adoption is a jurisdictional prerequisite to the filing of an adoption. In his example, if that young woman did not consent to the adoption of her child, no one could file that adoption here in Oregon under these facts. It simply wouldn't happen. And so you would have to presume that she had consented and then for whatever reason decided she wanted to revoke her consent in order to get to that position. But there's no way grandma or anyone else could file the adoption here absent her written consent. It's that simple.
So when my nieces and nephews come up to visit for the summer...
You don't get to go there, Chair Williams.
My wife says, why don't we adopt them? I can say, nope, not without their mom and dad's consent. Right.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. It's not only in the statute, it's in case law. It's been in case law for many, many years, and it's been in the statute for many years.
Are there questions for any of the witnesses? Yes, I'm sorry. Kick me next time if I'm not. Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, I have just a question to all three of you, mm-hmm. because in Section 13A, page 1 of the Act, or the bill, it says, notwithstanding ORS 109.714 or 741, as I look to that statute, which now we, if this bill passed, we would not have to consider, it seems that it, paragraph 1, B, sub A and B, does require that the child or child's parents have a significant connection with the state other than mere physical presence. It seems to me that you're omitting that requirement.
That's the whole...
Wait, let me finish.
Sorry.
And giving the court jurisdiction merely because the child and the adoptive parent has been here for, say, 6 months. Am I reading this correctly?
Representative Ackerman and Chair Williams, what is happening, you're looking at 3 small a, big A, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and it says notwithstanding 109.741. The reason it says that is because 109.741 sets forth what we call home state primacy. And that's where it says the child's home state for the last 6 months is primary. And what we are doing with Senate Bill 38 is saying not necessarily. We are, that is one of the choices. So let's say the child was born here in Oregon and the adoptive parents lived in Idaho, picking on Idaho. There would be jurisdiction in Oregon to file the adoption and finalize it here under our three little, small a and big A, but provided the child had been here at least 6 consecutive months, including those periods of temporary absence.
Well, I'm worried about an adoption proceeding eliminate the requirement that you'd have to show that the proposed adoptive parent and child had a significant connection with the state. It seems to me you're eliminating that requirement, putting us in a very difficult position, because it would be easier to prove an adoption, which basically involves a termination of parental rights, than you would if you're in a modification proceeding in a divorce.
What Senate Bill 38A does is it gives us different bases for jurisdiction. And one of them is if the child's been here at least 6 months. One is as if the adoptive parents, the petitioners, have been here at least 6 months. And this is at the time the adoption is filed. And in that case, they also have to show the substantial evidence. So if the adoptive parents have been here 6 months plus substantial evidence. And then we also have, if the consenting birth parent has been here at least 6 months, then Oregon would have jurisdiction. And so it's an or situation. And so maybe I'm not understanding your question correctly, but what we were attempting to do here was to be as protective as possible.
Maybe I can ask, and then I'll Representative Shirley. I mean, the situation, I think you said it in the early part of your testimony, and I actually have some friends who have done this where they have adopted a child, and the child, it was a private adoption.
Mm-hmm.
The child lived in another state, and they adopted the child from Oregon. And what you're saying is, because they lived in Oregon and adopted the child who wasn't in Oregon,
right,
there is a possibility that someone could object down the road to that Oregon adoption because the child wasn't in Oregon when they filed their adoption in Oregon.
Right now, yes, that's correct, right. Chair Williams.
And what you're suggesting is what this bill does is it creates the jurisdictional opportunity for adopting parents in Oregon to file their adoption proceeding in Oregon even though they're adopting a child out of state.
That is correct.
And David's objection to the bill is that in a case where there's been at least some indication that there's consent to the adoption, but then later challenged,
mm-hmm,
that the later challenge means that the birth parent, who is now, for whatever reason, decided to change their mind about the adoption, now has to fight that adoption in a state away from where they currently, mm-hmm, reside, but where the birth parents, or where the adoptive parents and now the child, is likely situated.
That's correct.
Is that that's the So the, mm-hmm, policy choice is, do we want to clarify those the rights of a set of adoptive parents who are adopting a out-of-state child in Oregon and sort of build a wall there and say that's, we're going to allow jurisdiction and not let jurisdictional issues put a cloud over that adoption action? Mm-hmm. Or, because some of the states have that, you can't be an out-of-state set of parents to adopt. Or are we more interested in protecting the interest of the out-of-state birth parent who, for whatever reason, now decides to change their mind about the adoption? Have I defined it relatively well?
Very well, Chair Williams.
Well, you'd have to say that. But
Representative Shetterly.
No, that was where I was going with that. I think it was good. And having been energized by my coffee,
you're now getting it.
I'm getting it.
Yeah.
Coffee for everyone.
Where do you get your coffee?
Lounge.
And you didn't bring anybody else any back either. That was a little selfish.
Well, Representative McPherson joined me. I assume this was...
Okay.
Chair Williams,
yes.
If I may, Kathy Ledesma. The Interstate Compact on the placement of children does provide another level of protection here, because all these children have to pass through that, and that really is a state-to-state agreement. And so there is another level of regulation on this. So the kinds of situations that Representative Ackerman was mentioning or maybe alluding to here, I think, you know, really could happen, but there's a tighter regulation on that because of the ICPC.
Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question that kind of popped into my mind, and that is, how will this affect foreign adoptions when a child, for example, is in China or Bulgaria and the parent is from Oregon and they're going to adopt the child? Is jurisdiction then defined by where the child is or by where the parent is?
If I may, Chair Williams, Representative Crummel, in nearly all of the international adoptions right now, and we also have a hand in that at DHS, nearly all of those adoptions are finalized in the country of the child's origin before the children even come here. Only a handful, and I can't give you an exact number, but it was in the low 100s of adoptions that actually were finalized here, having not previously been finalized in the child's country of origin. So very few of those.
Ms. Pope?
And that actually is a good point, Chair Williams and Representative Crummel. The primary countries where the adoptions are not finalized in the other country would be India and Korea. And the children come over here on a guardianship and then are adopted here akin to an agency adoption that we would do domestically. But, yes, this would actually assist in those because we would be relying on the jurisdictional peg of the petitioners being residents here for at least 6 months. So it would actually clarify that issue for those adoptions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 38. Well, before I do that, is there anyone else here that didn't sign up? All right, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 38A. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 38A.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Charlie,
energized as I am, I will move Senate Bill 38A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Charlie moves Senate Bill 38A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? All right, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker? Aye. Representative Jensen? Aye. Representative Crummel? Aye. Representative Pearson? Aye. Representative Pearson? Aye. Representative Shetterly? Aye. Vice Chair Ackerman? Aye. Vice Chair Anderson? Aye. Chair Williams? Aye.
Senate Bill 38A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody do adoption work?
We've got a number of adoptions in the family. There you go.
Well, Gordon, all right, you're the man. You're the man.
Just bought yourself a bill.
All right. And I'm sure they'll assist you with excellent talking points, Representative. All right, we're going to go to Senate Bill 194. Open a public hearing and invite up Mr. Is it Mattis? Did I get that right? All right, great.
Better get some more coffee.
Good afternoon.
It's a tough trap without coffee and a modifies or revises securities law description on your bill, Mr. Mattis. I just want you to know that after everybody's had lunch. So,
Mr. Chair, I will keep my testimony very, very brief. For the record, my name is Tom Mattis. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of DCBS. My testimony does lay out a more complete description of the provisions, but essentially this bill does three things. It first deletes obsolete references to registration of certain securities offerings and the licensing of certain investment advisor firms, clarifies our law, and it conforms it to federal law. Essentially, an act that was enacted in 1996 had some provisions with an operative period of 1996 to 99 that has now passed, and our law continues to make references to those provisions. Secondly, it deletes confusing references to the securities licenses of persons employed by mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, since those licensing requirements are now encompassed in the Oregon Mortgage Lender Law. They are no longer needed in the securities law. And finally, it modifies language and licensing provisions to clarify that persons acting in the broker-dealer industry and the investment advisor industry are subject to comparable treatment under the law.
This bill has had no testimony on it to date. There's been no opposition or controversy. It passed out of the Senate committee with a unanimous due pass recommendation, and it passed off the floor of the Senate without dissent on May 2nd. We respectfully ask for your support for the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions, and those I can't answer, I have somebody who can with me.
All right. Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'm probably it's the closest thing to a securities lawyer you're going to find on this panel, so I'll just ask this question, which is that it's been several years since this federal statute in 1996 was enacted, and I know it realigned sort of the configuration between state and federal regulation of brokers and investment managers. Why is it that it's taking till the 2003 session here for us to be conforming to what happened in 1996?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, I can't really answer that. I've been with the division 14 months, and I don't know that history. But we are cleaning it up now.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Flies in our own way.
And at our own speed. All right. Are there further questions for Mr. Mattis? Well, this is the kind of bill... with the relating clause relating to securities, that if the industry folks were nervous about Mr. Mattis, I suspect that they would be filling up this hearing room right now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the door was wide open, wasn't it?
and we would know about it because they would have been camping out in front of our offices. So my sense would have to be that the industry folks who would most be concerned about the changes in both definitions and the regulatory structure have looked at this and don't find any problems with it. Did you do a work group or work with before the session the traditional stakeholders and get some feedback on this?
Mr. Chair, with the risk of perhaps being corrected by my colleague, I believe we did run this by some people in the securities industry to make sure that there weren't any issues and none were raised.
Well, see, isn't that great? That's an agency doing its work ahead of time. I mean, that's the way it ought to be done. And this is what you get. You get the whole committee with just you and virtually nobody else in the hearing room. So that's
it's just about all the attention I can stand, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chair? Yes, Representative Sherry.
Are you sure there's no... Can we ask counsel for an opinion whether we can sandwich into this the survivorship on joint accounts?
In insurance? Yeah. Oh, no, you got Representative Barker all worked up again. We don't.
Hey, we'll put it on the consent calendar.
We don't want to make poor Mr. Mattis nervous. He's
already passed one chamber.
It came out on what day? At the Senate?
I believe on May 2nd, I believe.
And today's the 7th.
Whoa.
Talk about turnaround.
Let's hold this over.
Just for fun. Any other questions for him? We've had sport with him long enough. It's time to close the public hearing and open a work session.
Five months took the day. So the House 5 days.
Yeah, Representative McPherson.
I will move Senate Bill 194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 194 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And since he dubbed himself the closest thing this committee has to a securities lawyer, Representative McPherson will carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that concludes our agenda for the afternoon, colleagues. We are adjourned.